So two things are going to be different about this talk than other talks. One, after discussion with Fred, it's going to be mainly a chalk talk. I'm going to start with a couple slides, and I'm going to switch to the chalkboard. And two, I'm going to end at 11 o'clock. I don't care if it's mid-sentence I'm stopping at 11 o'clock. I'm shooting for 10 to 11, but we'll see. Okay. No, even with 8 extra minutes. This stuff is very straightforward. So I'll be talking about probabilistic. I can't even talk about it. I'm going to the next slide. Okay. So our goal is to understand how networks of neurons compute stuff, right? If we understand this, we're done. We're done with the brain. We get to move on to some other field. That's true, right, Fred? I mean, this is the brain computes stuff, takes stuff in and does stuff. Eventually, of course, we want to understand how it learns to compute, but I won't be talking about that at all today. So let me be clear what I mean by computation. It's sort of obvious. It's a mapping from X to Y, right? We call it some function. And because neurons are noisy, we're typically interested in probability distributions. The world may seem deterministic, but most of what we do is probabilistic. And we sort of can't even get by without some notion of probability. You can't even cross the street, right, without some estimate of when the car is coming and what a standard deviation is, right? If all you had was a value, you wouldn't know what to do. Okay, everybody knows this. Yes. Yeah. But you'll see. We'll see. So I'll do show specific examples later. We're ultimately interested in the kind of functions the brains compute. And I'll give you an example of one of the ones. No, I mean, if you show... That's not the question I ask you to ask. If you show the same stimulus over and over, you get a different response. Okay. And so there's lots of reasons they're noisy. There's probabilistic release, there's chaotic dynamics, there's noise in the outside world, noise in the transducers. Let's just take that as a given, all of those. So this is a function you need to compute, and of course, the brain computes it with networks of neurons. So the picture you have in mind of this, some variable x is encoded in population activity. A network takes rx to ry, and ry then codes for this variable y and does something useful. So let me give you an example. So x is an image, and rx now, let's see, we can take the spike trains, it could be anywhere in the visual system, let's say in the ganglion cell, okay? So this is rx, this is rx, it codes for this image, right? But let's say we want to compute whether or not there's a sunset in the scene. Okay, that's our computation. So y has this be a 0-1 variable. There's a mapping from the image to whether or not there's a sunset. And what you want to do is build a network of neurons to make this computation, okay? So there's a true probability P of y given rx, right? So given this activity, one could sit down and have had infinite data, infinite time, compute the probability of there being a sunset. But it's a really hard computation, right? What we want to do is a network that takes this rx and does another set of spike trains that codes in some sense for just for the sunset. And we call this Q of ry, and what we really want is to build a network so Q and P are as close as possible. Okay, we're never going to get it exactly, but that's our goal. And there's a very important constraint, and that is in some sense ry codes only for sunsets. I'm going to be more specific about exactly what this means. And you can see why you have that, right? Because this network could be the identity mapping. If you take every spike there and copy it there, you'll get Q will be exactly equal to P, but it will be completely useless, right? You won't have done anything. In fact, a lot of what the brain does is it takes some code in an incredibly complicated format and puts in a simple format so that the rest of the brain can compute with it.
So the concentration for
RX to
RY is also non-deterministic.
It's also non-deterministic. Anyway, so I'm constantly going to write this as a function, but it's non-deterministic. Depends on who you ask, right? Tony Bell would say it's completely deterministic. But he's probably the only one. Okay, so here's a picture, right? So we have some... What did you say?
Well,
it depends on how you define noise, right? The world is deterministic, right?
But the transformation from RX to RY is the transformation from neural activity to neural activity. So if you start by saying you don't have noise, the transformation has to be probabilistic also.
Yes. No, I agree with you 100%. I'm just saying there are people who would disagree with that.
So if there's a disagreement with data where you see exactly very precise spike trends,
so you never see that. You'll see a spike here and there that shows up at the same place every time you show really high contrast stimulus. But you never see whole spike trains. Well, if you get into the cortex, so if you look in like early auditory system, right? You can have network connections. They're locked, phase locked to the spikes. If you look in cortex, forget it, right? You never see the same spike turn twice. That's a different talk. My claim is because of chaotic dynamics, it's a huge amount of noise. What did you say? Should I switch talks? What did you say, Fred? Okay. Well, it actually is going to matter, and we'll see in what way. Okay, so here's the picture. So Rx codes for some true distribution P of y given Rx. And it's sort of complicated, right? It is a deterministic function. You have to do some complicated integral. If it's a non-deterministic function, it's a more complicated integral. And then there's some, you want to build a network so that says another distribution Q codes for P. You want to choose a network so that P is close to Q, or Q is close to P, and Ry is in some sense a pure code for Y. So quantitatively, what we do is minimize this KL distance between P and Q. Okay, that's a sort of our goal. Yes. And so I want to make a couple points. One point, really. In general, the kind of combinations the brain does are really, really hard. And they're hard by machine learning standards. They're typically considered intractable, right? So you have to use approximate methods. And so it's one step harder for us because we have to figure out how networks of neurons do it. So maybe networks of neurons are more clever than digital computers. That's what we're hoping. But sort of given that we don't know how clever they are, this is sort of a hard problem times two. Okay, so this is our goal, minimize this distance, and I'm going to consider three example computations, multisensor integration, computing a function of x and y, and then I'm going to talk about a real-life hard problem. Hard meaning there is no solution, or no solution you can compute in a reasonable amount of time. Okay, so that's it can I turn this off or down? This guy? Does anybody?
You're gonna use it again?
I'll use it again at the very, very end. Okay. Okay. So this is so three computations. So multisensor integration is basically you have two networks of neurons encoding for the same thing, and you want to combine them somehow. So the classic example, there's an object in the world, you can see it, you can hear it, and you want to know where it is, right? So we draw this sort of in the language we were drawing, there's some stimulus S, which we can think of as the location of the object, and S is encoded in two population activity, R1 and R2. So R1, I'm going to use squiggles, these are vectors. So this is a population R1 and population R2 coding for the same thing. We want to build a network. Another population R3 that now codes also for S. Okay? And we want sort of this R3, and now we can talk about what we mean by pure code. But anyway, let's draw the standard picture here. So this is S, and this is R1, I. And we sort of think this of noisy population codes. Okay. And this usual thing, we have some tuning curve plus noise, and the peak of the tuning curve more or less codes for S. Okay, so very, very standard. Over here we have R2i, and again we have neurons coding for S. And basically these things actually, so we can write down P of R1 given S. So that's our encoding model. And that's where the noise model becomes very important, right? It's no longer... David? So we're going to think of R as spike, let's say spike count. Okay. The method you'll see applies to any code you want. But we're going to use a very particular encoding model. So we're going to make statements about what the noise is. Yeah, so this is go back to Herb's question. What's a pure code, right? So we don't want to concatenate them. And we'll see. When I write down the encoding model, you'll see what's happening. Okay. So now, basically, I should have used colors here. If I had used orange and whatever color that is here. So this is via Bayes' theorem, right? We assume flat priors and everything and talk about that can be fixed. There's a posterior distribution, P of R, S given R1. Okay. If I tell you P of R given S and you have a prior, you know the posterior distribution. So given this spike train, we might say, okay, again, here's S. And this gives us a posterior distribution. All right? Looks something like this. And this also gives us posterior distribution. Because the firing rate's lower, it's probably going to be broader. Okay? So something like this. And so what we really wanted, and so the reason this problem is a little bit hard is on trial to trial, the reliability of these codes is going to change. Okay? So you can think of vision and audition, right? On a bright room, this you can have a lot of activity, you can have very narrowly peak prior, you should pay attention only to vision. In a dark room, you should pay attention mainly to audition. Okay? So you want to build a network that actually takes this into account and is able to compute. So we want sort of a mapping from this activity. I'll draw it down here. So here's R3, I versus S. We want some mapping from these two variables so that this thing shows up as a single peak somewhere, and it codes for now the true posterior, whatever that is. The combination of these posteriors is going to look something like this. Okay? It's going to weigh, well, it should be shifted over. It should pay more attention to the orange curve than the pink one, and should be a little bit narrower because it's combining two sources of information. Okay? So now we come to what is critical in all this, the encoding model. So in a motivated encoding model, we use from independent Poisson neurons. So let's say P of R given S was independent Poisson. In this case, this is a product on I. And let's say, so underlying this, we're going to think of some tuning curve. F of S, Fi of S. Okay? So this is, with some gain parameter G. So G tells you how big the peak is, right? The higher the gain, the more information there is, and the narrower the posterior. I labels neuron. Okay. So this is now for any population. We could put a Rx there. So this is G F I of S to the R I. E to the minus G F I of S over R I factorial. Standard. Small f is a tuning curve. F of S. So F sub I of S is the tuning curve is the preferred for a given S, G times F I is a firing rate of neuron I. G is not G sub I, yeah. G tells you the reliability, right? All neurons in population. Well, the point is, there are two. G is a nuisance parameter. There are two things going on. The peak of the distribution is coding more or less for where the value of S, but G is a nuisance parameter. It tells you how much information is in the population. In a dark, in a very bright day, G is going to be high if there's a vision. If it's dark, it's going to be low. No. Integral F has nothing to do with anything, right? So G times F sub I is So this is basically this thing here for neuron I. This is G times F sub I. This is G F I of S. It's a firing rate of neuron I. If particular stimulus is shown, and the particular gain is this value. No. G we want to integrate out. We don't want to learn it. So this is all inference, no learning. So we just want to infer S given these two populations, infer P of S given these two populations. So we're skipping, we're just doing in some sense half the problem, right? Possibly the easy half. Well, yeah, these are populations of neurons. You could have like two populations in, you know, but they want, so assuming here they're independent, right? So typically if they're in the same modality, they're probably going to be co-dependencies. R1 and R2 are independent. You can do it more complicated. Condition and stimulus, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, look, this is very, it could be anything, right? It could be, as long as you're two independent populations coding for the same thing. It could be a posterior, likely in a prior, right? That's also combined in the same way. Oh, yeah, this is the easiest problem in the world. Well, I mean, it's the second easiest problem in the world, right? If you fix G, then it's a really easy problem. So this is, so the G1, there's of course a G2 here, right? So this is G2 F of S. Okay. Anyhow, we'll write this as, let's write it over here. This is E to the RI log FI of S. What's not? So I'm going to assume. Look, I'm going to assume it is. It doesn't matter. If you guys want to know what happens with different Fs, we can talk. Probably best to talk about that later. But you can have different Fs, and everything is fine. I'll tell you. I'll just sort of tell you what would have been different. But right now, let's assume they're the same. Okay. So we have this. So we're going to take E. So we get RI log FI of S. We have my plus RI log G. Sum on I. We have minus a sum on I of G Fi of S. And then we have minus log Ri factorial, again, the sum on I. Okay? So this thing has a particular form. So first of all, we assume, as we all assume, that these somehow these things are dense. So this is independent of S. Okay, if you take a bunch of tuning curves, let's say, especially circularly, add them all up, they're going to be independent of S. Okay. This term is also, we're going to write this term, so we're going to write this now as equals E to the H of S dot R, where HI of S, in this case, is log FI of S. It's a log of a tuning curve. Okay. Then we have, this term is just a function of R. So we just write some function of R and gain. Sort of these terms are just some function of R and some function of gain. S is gone. Okay? So this is an independent Poisson has this form. You can write down specifically what phi of R and G is. What we're going to use, this is called a linear. It's not the worst name in the world, but maybe it's close. We call this a linear PPC. So we're just going to assume that P of R given S is phi of R and G e to the H of S dot R. That's going to be our encoding model. And we're going to now allow phi to be anything. So you can take into account arbitrary correlations. You can put anything you want. Okay. What's critical is that there's no S dependence in here. And there's a linear, the linear part is basically the kernel is linear. Okay. This is not a bad model. So you can actually add in some function of S if you want. You can make this, this could depend on S. So in the more sophisticated versions, we have some version where this is actually S dependence. Okay, but we're going to ignore that. So you can use this is exponential family of linear sufficient statistics. Yeah. Because Poisson's independent, the neurons aren't. This has some reasonable features. If neurons have constant Fano factor, it's consistent with that. It takes into account correlations. It's not a bad model, but it's not the model of the brain, right? It's really not the correct statistics. Richard? Allard's model would be part of that, right? Yeah, I was going to mention that. So Allard's model, as a little aside, well, not all of you were here last week, but a lot wrote down a model. Phi of x given s is e to the h of s dot x plus 1/2 x dot j dot x over normalization, which depended on s. Okay? So this model we could actually write down as this part is e, this the first part is phi of x, that's e to this term. He had an eta of s, which acted a little bit like a prior, and then e to the h of s dot x. So his model fell into that class. Okay. So it's a fairly rich class, which we haven't really exploited. We generally sort of assume things are linear independent of Poisson. Okay. Well, yeah, it's a conditional, it's a likelihood function or a conditional distribution. In this case, for independent Poisson, it doesn't. We're going to assume the encoding model of the brain is it doesn't depend on S. All the S dependence lives in the exponential family. It's linear. Okay? And what we're going to see is, we're going to give you a general approach. You give me an encoding model and a computation, and I'll tell you what the network is. So we've picked an encoding model, we're going to pick the computation, we're going to write down the network. No. It doesn't have any. And it's not because... So it tells you the correlational structure. Okay? It's nothing super special, right? Yeah, the correlation could condition on S, right? So in Lod's case, the correlational structure was this Ising model, but you can have even more complicated correlational structure. No. There's no S dependence here. You can add an S dependence. You don't really want to add an S dependence in there. You might want to add a multiplicative S dependence. If you add an S dependence in there, then it becomes a nightmare. All bets are off, right? Okay, I'm going to write down. So basically, I don't know. If you the tuning curve is basically f. So if you write f equals f I. So f is a collection of Fine weights for neuron I. F prime of f equals a correlation inverse times h prime of s. And let me see. I believe that this thing is going to be sinus independent. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Correlations are sinus independent. We should talk about this maybe. In Lod's model, the correlations depend on J and H. And that's probably because there's this eta of S sitting in there, right? No, even those two. It's really complicated. You can't read off the correlation just from J in the Ising model. You need J and H. Right? Any physicist going to back me up on this? Better shake his head, yes. But so his model is actually more complicated because it's got this extra eta of S term here, normalization. So in his case, his correlations are sinus dependent. In our case, I have to think about it, but I believe they're not. But I'm not absolutely positive. Some versions, we do put an eta of S in here, and the correlations can become sinus dependent.
Can I interpret this then as some kind of maximum entropy?
No.
Work
where
you're constraining the dependence of the
stimulus? I say, I ask these things with utter confidence. Let me rephrase that. I don't think so. I would give this only an 80% probability. I've never even thought about it like that, but I don't know. I'm pretty sure no, because you can put any phi here, right? So there may be some, this may be a max distribution with respect to some constraints.
But the thing looks like this EHFS thing looks like...
Yeah, but you look up there, right? EHFS, that phi of x was e to the 1 f x dot j dot x, right? So this is max with respect to second order. If you have a different phi, it won't be maximum with respect to second order, right? Maybe it's maximum with respect to something. Yeah. Okay, so now we can talk about the question what people meant by pure code. So I can now, I think, erase all this, right? Nobody shook their head no. Did somebody shake their head no? So by the way, so before I talked to Fred, I made a whole set of slides, which has all the equations, which I can put online. Yeah, yeah. I could even sort of do it now, right? But probably should have done it ahead of time. But okay, so we're going to write down P of R1 given S. Okay, so as long as I stay below the shadow, I'm good, right? Oh, I see. Okay. So that question's easy. Pretty soon you'll be going to ask me to write neatly, and that's harder. Okay. So P of R2 given S. Okay, so that's the encoding model. And now what we're going to demand is P of R3 okay. So this, go ahead. What do you say? So they're going to change from trial to trial, because there are different reliabilities in every trial, right? Change the light. It's in a visual key, you change the light level, and the amount of information goes down. So we have to be clear what we mean by S. The say it again. Okay, so the full stimulus. More sides here. We're going to write big S equals S comma G, right? That's the stimulus. That's all the information, right? So yeah, I've been a little bit sloppy. S is what we care about. In this case. Well, let's take the case of an object, a white object on a black screen in various levels with various contrasts, right? So the position of that object is S, and the contrast is G. So it's not, so you're saying that I have a bad encoding model. So you're saying I have a bad encoding model? Which is fine, because it's not a perfect encoding model, but it's not a bad encoding model for lots of stuff, right? A lot of times, you see, so for, especially for vision and orientation, you see contrast and variant tuning curves. So this basically form is basically says, these are contrast and variant tuning curves. So it's multiplicative with gain. It doesn't always happen, right?
Yeah, I mean,
because it makes inference a lot harder. It makes inference a lot harder, right? So I'm choosing an encoding model that makes inference as easy as possible. And if you give me a different encoding model, I'll get a different network out. The network will be more complicated, okay? So I should say that basically, what'd you say? Well, because we'll see in a second. This is not none of the, so big S, we don't, little s is what we care about. Big S is the full stimulus, right? And this is a standard thing. We always have nuisance parameters we want to integrate out. This is basically what the brain does at the front end. It throws away all the stuff we don't care about. And that's it, and basically puts it in some form, and those things are gone. It's the notation isn't so bad. What I'm saying is a little bit sloppy, right? Because if I'd said right away, here's the stimulus, and S and G are the stimulus makes made up of S and G, and we care about S, you would have been happier. I did tell you I was changing it. But I mean, so this is important, right? The brain, in some sense, has to estimate G and S and then throw out G, right? For this particular model, life is really easy because if we write down the posterior distribution, this is P of R1 given S, P of S over, Shoot, that was my best piece of chalk. Integral ds prime, p of r1 given s prime, p of s prime, okay? And this thing is now, we can write that as phi of r1g e to the h of s dot r1 over phi of r1g integral, oops, I forgot p of s, e to the h of s prime dot r1 p of s prime. And the point is, these guys cancel. The posterior is independent of the gain. This is basically why we picked it. If you do something even slightly look very innocuous, like add new zero here, right, then the posterior isn't independent of the gain. And in fact, so this is true for only a handful of things. Like it's true for it's for oriented bars in V1, right? It's true for probably a few other things. But that doesn't really matter, right? We could have put this in, we would have had a harder inference problem and more complicated network. Are you happier? Okay. Why aren't you happy? So we know that for oriented bars, right? You change the contrast of oriented bars, and it's contrast invariant, just multiplicative. For not all neurons, but a lot of neurons. But okay, so this is. I mean, in some sense, it's critical. There are really one part to the talk. Choose an encoding, well, two parts. Choose an encoding model, choose a computation, get a network out, right? So we should take away, if you don't like my encoding model, you can stick your own in and turn the crank, right, in your own way. But there are a couple critical points that basically sort of, in some sense, stumped us for a long time. And what the thing is, why not just how do we formally get rid of the approach of just concatenating together activity and getting the. So if independent Poisson, right? If you change the gain, it's just a standard thing, right? The Fanon factor stays the same, the mean, as the gain goes down, the variance goes down, the Fang rates go down. Think independent Poisson. And all your intuition about independent Poisson pretty much goes through. No, independent Poisson, which I erased, right? As the contrast goes up, the mean goes up and the variance goes up. Signal to noise goes down, goes up, because the variance over the standard deviation over the mean is smaller.
Can you scale it down?
Say it again?
If the contrast goes up, the mean and the noise go up, the gene has to scale down again?
Let's go back to independent Poisson. All right, so for a single Fang rate, a neuron with Fang rate nu and time t, right? So p of n equals nu t to the n e to minus nu t over n factorial, right? This is what you should have in the back of our mind. So the mean value of n equals nu t, and the variance of n equals nu t, and the standard deviation over the n, and so the standard deviation over the mean goes like 1 over the square root of nu t. So signal to noise goes up as Fang rate goes up, but sort of the mean and the variance just go up also. So the gain would be the firing rate. You turn the gain up, the firing rate of all the neurons go up. Okay? The tuning curve just goes up and down multiplicatively. Yeah, oh, it does. R gets bigger. Because R is bigger, because R depends on G, right? Yeah. Fred's happy. Anybody else happy? 1 out of 30? It's not bad. Okay. So what's important here is we've said, okay, here's P of R3 given S. Okay? So this guarantees that R3, basically what it doesn't, what we're going to do is if we see R3, we're going to interpret the encoding model via this equation, and we interpret the posterior via this equation. Okay? And in general, after we run the neurons through the network, this is not going to be the correct distribution, right? So we're doing approximate inference. So in some sense, we're taking distribution, projecting it onto this distribution, and that's what we're going to do. And we have to do approximate inference because these problems are really, really hard. Okay? So once we do that, this problem becomes very easy. There's a big piece of white chalk. Let's go up. Okay, so flat prior. Okay. So now we can write down P of S given R1, R2 populations is proportional to P of R1, R2 given S. This is a P of S, but it's flat, so it goes away. Equals P of R1 given S, P of R2 given S, equals phi of R1, G1, phi of R2, G2, e to the h of s dot R1 plus R2. Okay? And basically, because it's posterior, this thing goes away. It's posterior here. This guy is proportional to e to the h of s dot r1 plus r2. Okay? So what's our network? R3, so here's our network. It gets a different color because it's important. Yeah? Oh, it depends on, you could have h1 and h2. We can. I'll just tell you what happens. I won't consider that case. We can talk about it later. I'll tell you what happens. So the network, here's our network. R3 equals R1 plus R2. So we just add the spikes from the two populations. Well, we assume this encoding model, right? Now everything is fine. Well, yeah, so, I mean, yeah, equal numbers are insane. So if you have different tuning curves, different numbers of populations, what happens is you get R3 equals some vector matrix dot R1 plus another bad notation. So under weak conditions on the tuning curves, okay? It's still linear, okay? So this is actually this. So what have we done, right? We've written down an encoding model. We had a computation. We turned the crank. We out popped the network. And this is actually exactly the right network. There's no approximation. Under this, so this is P of R3 now falls into this class. The network basically counts spikes and spits out spikes. It's actually a hard network to build, right? So we can do firing rates, we can do various things. It's sort of a hard network to build, right? But this, so we can now, so this is the network that will preserve all the information. Hey, David, this isn't the sunset computation. This is the Q integration computation. We're going to get to harder computations. This isn't a network that's going to work for the sunsets. This is a network that's going to work for Q integration and nothing else. Richard? This is not called multisensory different H's. Okay, but if you have different H's, I erased it. It's linear.
So presumably you can calculate how much information you've thrown away.
Yeah, so if you do this, you're throwing away zero. Right? The posterior is exactly the same. This is a true posterior.
You're throwing away zero. Of course, now your network is spiking, and you don't know if the spike came from sensory modality 1 or sensory modality.
Doesn't matter. But look at, this is a true posterior, right? This is a posterior under this model. So P of S given R3 is proportional E to the H of S dot R3, and they're the same. If your network does this, they're exactly the same. You've lost zero information. Yeah. The procedure is encoding model, computation, network. And now we can think about how to implement a network, right? You start implementing a network, you start with real biological neurons, you're going to lose information. Okay? Neurons are noisy, they're recurrent, you don't really want to pair one neuron up to another. Having a single neuron count the presynaptic spikes in a postsynaptic neuron is a really hard problem. Well, here's a network, right? Here's a neuron. These are both spiking. You get spikes coming down here. So every time there's a spike, any spike, in some sense you could do it, right? Every spike here produces a spike in the output neuron. The primary is not too large, it's pretty easy to make giant PSPs, right? But networks don't have this structure, right? So this procedure is going to tell you what the network is. It's not going to tell you whether or not it's biologically possible or how to build it. Okay? Yes. Don't show up when I'm talking. Okay. That was a joke. So really the take-home message is the procedure, right? I want to say one more thing and then I'll summarize what we learned. Okay? So we can actually sort of see what's going on here, right? So I'm going to say two more things. So population of neurons there, population of neurons there. We just add them, right? So we get population of neurons that are sort of at different scales, right? What do you say? Okay. S, R1. R2, R3, S. Just like my advisor, he'll just yell at me about this. And I yell at my students. Okay, you just add spikes, right? So the tuning curves sort of get, let me put these on the same scale. So we can sort of see. Actually, let me put R1 here. R2 here. And then we add them together. And we get R3, right? And it's basically because R1 had bigger gain, it makes a bigger contribution to R3, and that makes sense because it had bigger gain and it had a narrow posterior, right? So everything works out just fine with this particular encoding model. The fact that you've lost information about where the spikes came from doesn't hurt you when you want to know about S. Less information of a G, but this is fine. Most of what the brain does is throw information. We want to know. Yeah. You lose about G?
Well, you lost information about whether your information came from sight or sound.
But this is what you want to do. We didn't bother to calculate. You could. It wouldn't be that hard. You could even calculate how much information you lost about gain, right? That's basically all you know is a final gain, so it's your priors on gain tell you. Okay. So if you'd had Gaussian tuning, Gaussian noise, the network would have been a lot more complicated. Okay, and it's sort of easy to see why. For Gaussian noise, right, you plot R, it's a tuning curve, so you have some tuning curve, F of S, and then the amount of noise around that, which presumably varies from trial to trial, tells you how reliable it is, right? So if there's not much noise, so the firing rates are very close to the tuning curve, you have a narrow posterior. If you have a wide posterior, you have a lot of noise, right? So you can no longer just, but sort of the mean is the same in both cases. And you can no longer just add spikes. You get a much, much more complicated network. The simple case of additive Gaussian noise makes Q integration a lot harder. A multi-sensor integration a lot harder. Let's write something down. So this is would be F of S minus R squared over sigma squared. It's not in this. So the problem is sigma squared depends on gain. It's not an exponential family. It's not in this exponential family of linear sufficient statistics. So the gain appears in here, right? Yeah. So it would be, that's a good point. H of S comma G dot R, right? So you can, now it's hard to integrate out the G. Okay, thank you for bringing that up. Okay, so there are two things to take home from this very, very simple example. So one, the encoding model matters. You know, I've completely forgotten what 2 is. Every now and then stuff just goes out of my brain. It'll be back. There are two. Independent of each other. Yeah. Condition on S, they're independent of each other. The condition on S, each one is correlated. Yeah, this linear sufficient statistic form. If this was circular, yeah, of course, then it wouldn't be. Generally, no. So if it were periodic, right? Then of course, let's say if it's periodic, then yes, it can be, right? In general, though, you have prior dependence on both G and S. It's probably very weak G dependence. Yeah, I get something relatively flat. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So in fact, I really wish I knew what 2 was. I'm going to go back to my slides, and then I'll look at it. I'm not sure. Combination matters. So you start with an encoding model, and basically, this is it. The computation. Thank you, Chuck. Okay. So, encoding model, I'm going to put number 3. And number 3 was an insight. Okay, the insight is, so specify the form of the output distribution and minimize DKL. We didn't minimize DKL, we did, but we did in our head, it was so easy. Minimize DKL between P and Q. So Q is now, this is something that basically stumped us for a long time, right? How do you, it's an under constrained problem. You can always take your input and just concatenate together and you've done a perfect job, right? So now if you specify the form of the output population, now you can actually have a problem you can solve now, right? And that actually works surprisingly well. So now we're on to part two. So, you know, these things shouldn't be surprising to anybody who thinks about this, right? So the answer is I don't know, but if we were surprised, we shouldn't have been, right? In some sense, this and all this, so the two key, I've been working this area for like 15 years, and really the insight was this one, honestly. I mean, that's kind of dumb too, right? Any machine learning person would have told me to do this 15 years ago, right? What do you say? Experiments? So the art in all this is choosing an encoding model that's consistent with what we see in the brain and building a network that's consistent with what we see in the brain, right? Because basically, we're going to now consider a case that's much harder. So let's now consider a harder case that's sort of more interesting. Okay? So now we have P of... So again, I can basically... I'll just write it here. I'll write it over here. So we have now an encoding model. I'm just going to write down. We're going to have P of X P of R X given X equals phi of R X comma G e to the H So now we're going to allow sort of an arbitrary h, and p of r y given x I'll give you a simple x. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to do this one, z equals x plus y, okay? That's our computation. And we can think of x as the location of an object in retinal coordinates, y are the location of your retina in your head, and z is the location of the object in head-centered coordinates. So that would be a computation. But this, you can think sensory motor transformation. You can think of you know, x, y, z, w, position of your hand, and z is a bunch of muscles you want to move to reach out and grab it. So this is in principle arbitrary, but we're going to consider something simple. Okay. Okay, so we're going to also write P of RZ given Z equals phi of RZ comma GZ e to the H Z of, sorry. Okay. So this is our encoding model. I'm going to put a Q here. I should have been putting Qs the whole time, okay? Because now, let's write down what P of... We want to build a network such that it takes as input, so basically RZ equals some function, which is non-deterministic, of RX and RY, and let's put down some parameters here. Depends on some parameters. Okay? Like the weights, for instance, single neuron properties, such that DKL of P of RX, So Q of Z given RZ is as small as possible, is minimum. Okay? And in this case, Rz is this function which in general will be non-deterministic. This is now a very well-defined problem, and we get to minimize it with respect to these parameters and this h. Right? And we may, you know, so this is presumably given by the brain, and we're going to minimize respect to this h, right? And the thing is, even if this is a wrong encoding model, we'll get something out, right? So this is going to, so let's write down what p of z given rx and ry is, right? So p of z given rx and ry is integral dx dy delta of z minus f of x comma y p of x given rx p of y given ry. Say it again. We're going to, that's, so, okay. I got rid of that question by getting rid of the box. Okay, so this is an important equation. Whether or not you can parse that, it doesn't really matter. You're trying to put the screen down? Okay. So this integral is, in general, hard. In general, we can't even do it, right? That's comment number one. Comment number two, this p is not even going to be in this family, right? So now we're in approximate inference land. So we have, now we're kind of, but in principle, we can write down a network and do this minimization. It might be hard, but we can do it, right? We can maybe think about learning to do it. Yes. Didn't everybody like that? Yeah. So the true distributions live on some complicated manifold, often known as a simplex. So our class lives along here. The true one lives here. We want to find the parameters so that we live as close as possible within this class. Okay? Yeah. But now we have a little bit of a problem, because what network do we use? I mean, yeah, we kind of have a choice, but they're sort of an infinite number. So what we're going to do is we do what physicists always do, which is
I'm sorry, if I look at this equation, what's wrong with saying that h of c dotted onto ic has to be equal to h selected x dot into rx plus h divided y dot into ry?
Oh, that won't give you the right posterior. Right, because we have to do the integration. We know in the Q integration we get to multiply them. Now we have to integrate something out. Yeah, yeah. No, I didn't say that. I should have said that maybe, but I didn't. We choose an encoding model. So we choose an encoding model that we think is not so far from what the brain uses.
Okay, so it's constrained by the brain.
It's constrained by the brain.
Because otherwise, I could choose whatever encoding model.
Yeah, 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 yeah. We sort of force the encoding, the brain sort of forced the encoding model on us, and we have to stick with it.
The brain is forcing the encoding model, but also
the telling us for the encoding model and tell us what networks we can use. Nobody really knows. So in spite of the comments in the back of the room when Jackie was talking, what I really, really want is networks that have nonlinearities, the kind of ones she talked about. So, you know, in the old days, I would have said linear summation followed by nonlinearity. But we're going to actually consider more complicated networks. Anyhow, what we're going to do is we're going to solve a problem. We can consider a problem we can solve. Yeah. So the point is, we can turn the crank now, right? We have a procedure. We have encoding models. We have an output encoding model. We have a true posterior. We can minimize its function. We can pick any network we want, and we're going to get a network out, right? No. We have to take this network and look at it and say, the network we have to say, how do we implement this particular transformation? So the network, in some sense, we're going to get an F when we're all done, right? That's going to be deterministic. And so what we're going to say is, given this F, what's the closest biologically plausible network we can get to it? So in some sense, I should have taken this space, right? So the true distribution lives here. This is P of Z given Rx and Ry. This is our space of these guys. So this analysis is going to tell us how to get here, and then we're going to wander off over here because of biology. Right? And then we'll make a prediction. Big F is what? No. Q, this is Q. We've given ourselves Q, right? Q has some free parameters. We're allowed to vary. No. The network parameters is a mapping from Rx and Ry to Rz. So the network parameters live here. The encoding parameters live there. And we get to vary both of them.
So you're saying that's the tuning curve.
I mean, this is sort of the log of the tuning curve, more or less, in the Poisson case. So.
But that thing doesn't really exist, right? It's just
that the corner there are tons of them. Say it again? Wait, sorry. What's the statement? So you can find neurons, you can find certainly neurons, you can find cells tuned for the retinas. There are certainly cells that tell you the direction of your eyes and your head. And I'm 99.9% sure there are cells that tell you the direction of the optic relative to your head. You mean because they have these sigmoidal tuning curves?
Well, because they just do this computation, right? They have a regular map, and then you have I position getting to, or whatever, you combine those two, then you get a sensor.
Yeah, but there's a network that does that, right?
But what I don't understand is why you put it into the image.
So there's a population of neurons coding for the position of the object relative to your head. That's this population, RZ. Right? There's some neurons coding for where this object is relative to your head. Some population of neurons. You read, look at the population activity, you know where it is.
RC is a function of Rx and Ry, right? Yeah. Oh, okay, now here.
Yeah.
The
this is a network.
I saw mechanistically, you were saying that there has to be a sensory input in Z coordinates for the purpose.
So, what you're saying is that if you know what you put F, that is to say, what is the computation?
Yes.
How you
subtract the network? Yes. So wait, so these guys you measure.
You also measure here.
No, what do you... So, yeah, I mean, you look at, for a particular computation, you might, let's say you know the computation, right? You know that there's, you take this particular computation with transformation to head-center coordinates. You might go in and look at and find the population that's coding for this and know H. In that case, you only get to vary these guys. Why not? How? But I mean, so where does P come from? This is a true P, given these guys, right? I mean, in some sense, this is what we're doing, right? So this is, if we minimize this, will find F. There may be other ways to find F. Right? Remember, there is no F that's going to make this zero in general. Because this is probably not in this family. Right? So I did no no sorry I determine. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Right, and therefore, you've got to get something which is perfect to be in this form as close as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not exactly at all, so that's a good point. It's not exactly all distributions are in this form, but a computation is going to return something. If you care about where this object is relative to your head, you're going to build a network in your brain that returns some population activity that can be read out in this form approximately. Yeah, so that's another thing one could do, right? Minimizing is easiest. So we could say enough information as we want. I mean, that'd be another possibility, right? Yeah, because I have now 13 minutes. Yes, yeah, of course. We need to spy space of networks. So what we're going to do, in some sense we sort of know that, right? Because we know a lot about biology. But I'm going to take a slightly different approach and consider this problem, C equals X plus Y. And that's going to give us a particular network, and then we're going to use that network in other problems. Okay? So I'm going to leave this up. So, I'm going to go to a new level. Okay, so we're going to z equals x plus y. Oops, sorry, check. So these are Gaussian. So that means there's a mu x and a sigma x squared. So any particular trial, I'm going to write down an encoding model in a second, but any particular trial, there's a mu x and a sigma squared, there's a mu y, a sigma y squared, and then there's going to be mu z and a sigma z squared, right? So if we could build a network that maps these mean invariances, and we can even write down mu z equals mu x plus mu y, and sigma z squared equals sigma x squared plus sigma y squared. Okay? So if we could write down that with encoded the means and encoded the variances, then we'd be done. So now I'm going to actually write down a model that does that. So P of Rx equals phi of Rx comma G x e to the minus 1/2 A dot Rx x squared over 2 plus B dot Rx times x. Okay? So this is Gaussian. Got x squared terms. And its mean, so the mean mu x is B dot Rx over A dot Rx. Its variance, sigma x squared, equals 1 over A dot Rx. Okay, we can see this if we want by writing this as this is E to all this. Okay. So that's one of that is variance, and that's the mean. Okay. And then similarly for P of Ry given Y, I won't write it down, but we're going to have mu y equals P dot Ry over A dot Ry. And sigma y squared equals 1 over A dot Ry. Okay? And what do A and B look like? I'll draw them over here. This is versus I, so A sub I. You can make it anything you want. We sort of took it to be constant. So A sub I equals A. And B sub I is actually something that's orthogonal to it, sort of makes life convenient. Okay? And now if we look at activity R, this is R, I versus I. So if you have activity that's sort of big, okay, big and positive on this side, that means B dot R is going to tend to be positive, so mu is going to be positive, and A dot R is going to be kind of big, so the variance is going to be kind of small. So the higher the activity, the smaller the variance. This has a useful feature. If, on the other hand, Ri looks something like this, so this is mean greater than 0, sigma squared small. This is mean less than 0, because now these Rs dotted into B are going to be negative, and sigma squared is now big, because A dot R is small. The smaller the activity, the bigger the variance. This is something we want in a neuron. And sort of where R peaks tells you the value of the mean. And this is in the class because this is, we can write this as equal to this term here is equal to h of x dot Rx, where h of x is minus 1/2 or minus x squared over 2a plus xb. Okay, that's our kernel. Okay? So this is the point I made earlier. You gave me an encoding model in computation, and now the rest is going to be easy. Right? Because mu z equals 1 over A dot R z equals 1 over A dot Rx plus 1 over A dot Ry. And sigma z squared equals B dot Rz over A dot Rz. No. This is going to tell. This is a point, right? We're going to turn the crank. The network's going to pop out. Equals 1 over, sorry, b dot rx over a dot rx plus b dot ry over a dot ry. Okay? Which? The sigmas are, thank you. Okay. So these equations tell us what the network is. If we write down a transformation from Rx and Ry that satisfies these, it will lose no information. We'll carry out the computation perfectly. Okay? It doesn't matter. We're going to keep it the same, but it could be different. So you can make, A depends on X, Y, and Z. Solve this equation, you have the network. Okay? Solve for, this is now, find a mapping from Rx and Ry to Rz that such that this is satisfied. And that's pretty easy to do. So we have A dot RZ equals A dot Rx, A dot Ry over A dot Rx plus A dot Ry. Oh, the B is a little harder, but B dot Rz equals okay? So that's a few lines of algebra. The first one you can do in your head, the second one you can do. I can't do it in my head, but I did it yesterday. It might not even be right. I think it's right. Okay, so this is, so now, in the case that A dot B equals zero, the network looks like this. RZ equals A over A dot A times A dot Rx, A dot Ry over A dot Rx plus A dot Ry plus B over B dot B times all this stuff plus C times any function of Rx and Ry. Actually, as long as A dot C okay. 3 minutes. Okay. So this actually told, so we actually didn't go through this minimization process. Okay? But what we did get, and if I had more time I would have continued with this. We got a network that's works for this function, and it's got an interesting feature. It's got divisive normalization, which we see in the brain all the time. Okay? And it's got this quadratic term, which we never see in the brain. But we really, really, really want neurons to behave like this. So it turns out. So in some sense, when all is said and done, We write RZI just write down So for years and years and years, I really wanted neurons to be linear summation followed by nonlinearity because that was easy. Now I start to do computations, I want much more complicated neurons. Okay? So really, we really want neurons to behave like this. If neurons behave like this, then we could build an optimal network. Richard? Yes. So I got 40 seconds. I'm going to stop here. So actually, I add one more thing. I may go over a little bit. So what we do in practice is this. Yeah, so it turns out that you can add a linear term to this and network will work just fine. And now this is a little more reasonable. This is a perturbation. And now this you can actually get in neurons. So I'm going to stop here. I'm stopping. Well, I'm not stopping because I have the last word because I'm going to go 1 minute over. So what's the take-home message? The take-home message is pick an encoding model. Pick an output encoding model. Don't try to do the computation exactly because it's too hard. And build a network that takes one from the other via, we chose to minimize this decay distance, but you can use anything you want, right? The key insight is to choose an encoding model, not try to be exact. And now all we have to do is go through, work out all the computations the brain does, derive networks, make them biologically plausible, make predictions they don't match, we'll come up with another network, and eventually we'll figure out how the brain works. Okay, so I'm done. So if anybody wants to leave, I will continue to talk. But if anybody wants to leave, no one will be heard.
So for X plus Y, you gave example of position.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at the very gross level, we do. That's not true. I know that my computation is go into a room, see a cup that I put there a while ago, pick it up, and drink it, right?
Yes, but you don't know whether you can apply some computation to a room. You don't know whether it's a mathematical computation.
No, but we know the input-output, right? We know the input and the output, right? This is all we need to know. This is not a program that's going to be easy, right? So what we're working on is now is much harder problems we didn't get a chance to talk about. We're going to start looking at hard inference problems. They're still relatively simple by the standards of picking up a cup. And, you know, derive networks, look in the brain, go back and forth, and this is really the program. It's going to work, right? So the one we're looking at is a simplified olfaction model, where basically the odorant, you have some odorant, it's basically sparse over concrete. So J labels odors in the world, bacon, orange juice, pancakes, right? This is 0-1 variable present or absent, and this is its concentration. If it's present, O is the activation of the motor, and RI is Poisson. What'd you say? Odorants, odorant receptors, right? Really simple model. So this R might be Poisson of this thing. So given a bunch of R's, infer P of S. So it's inference in a particular sparse over a complete representative model, right? And we, you know, we're thinking about it. So we're starting with sort of things that are, and this is in tractable machine learning standards. We've been trying to do inference on this for months and getting nowhere. So we can think of, you know, problems like this that are hard, and try to understand what kind of networks would be logically plausible. We know sort of where to look for them, and we can look for them. So the networks are all deterministic that we end up with. Well, no, yeah, but the network itself is always deterministic. And then we have to say, what happens when we add noise to that? Because that's, we believe, okay. So, I mean, the question, you know, if we relax things, you'll get the broader class. I mean, it's, we haven't done that. Well, I mean, this is, yeah, so I mean, that's, that we may have to do that, right? So we sort of just started the hard problems, and we'll see, right? And you know, the thing is, you get a network, even if you get a network, which is hard, what's the chance of it being biological plausible? It's a lot of work taking, you know, the correct network and turning it into a biological plausible network. Yes, exactly. In this case, that would have worked just fine, right? In the general case, it doesn't. Yeah. So in the case where the case where this can be done, where Q is equal to P, then you can do lots of stuff, right? But in general, we have to take this network parameters and just minimize decay by brute force. So I want to mention my collaborators. Who's at Gatsby? Very smart postdoc at Gatsby, who's been involved with this for a long time, and Alex Puget, who I've been working with basically since we started working on z equals x plus y like 15 years ago. And funding came from these guys. I am done. Not too bad.